I'm Fulbrunners.
And I'm Mike Halverson. We're a student faculty research team in the Department of History at Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, Washington. And welcome to Innovative History, a podcast brought to you by Dale Benson and the Benson Family Foundation. Innovative History shows history in motion and is driven by academic and technological breakthroughs.
For this episode, we're discussing history and how music interacts with cultural forces in history. We're also seeing how music impacts historical storytelling and what the potential this exciting medium is doing for people learning about and teaching history. Today we're asking, how is music used by historians as a way to learn about the past? Where did written music come from and why was it created? In what ways does music enrich our understanding of people, cultures, and society?
The episode description has a complete list of resources.
After the short break, we're beginning our discussion of music and history and how it's being used in creative ways to study the past.
The Benson Family Foundation supports a range of academic initiatives at PLU, from student scholarships to faculty and staff programming to research fellowships that pair students and faculty members together to research interesting topics in business and economic history, innovation, and other areas. During summer 2021, three student faculty research teams are exploring new subjects at PLU, including Fulton Brian Anderson and I on new directions in historical research. We are deeply grateful to the Benson Family Foundation for their support. You're listening to the style of some of the first music that was written down in the Latin West, a religious text that was preserved by musical notation in the last quarter of the 9th century Common Era. This is Gregorian chant, a product of European Christianity and scribal culture, and it was used as liturgical music in Roman Catholic churches, just as likely monasteries, where people were singing every day with this type of music. And it's some of the oldest music that we have written sources for. Now, medieval chant has a soothing sound, and it's popular today as a musical genre of its own, but why would historians be interested in this type of music? Is there something special that studying music like this might tell us if we look more closely? Fulton and I are here to investigate the history of music and what it can teach us as historians. Music history or musicology has a long and venerable history, but for some reason, it has not impacted written history too much. Let's see why. Welcome again to Innovative History.
To begin this episode of Innovative History, Mike, I want to ask you this. What is music at its core, and how long have human beings created music in their cultures?
Well, music is a combination of sounds and rhythm created by human bodies or musical instruments, and music seems to have been created for a long time. Musicologists suspect that for 30,000 years, human beings in small groups or growing societies have created music in some way or another. Music is therefore a product of culture and society, and it seems like every society in the world, every culture we can study, has in some way created music, used music for some of its rituals or some of its activities, some of its religious concepts. And because of this, music, if you think about it, is kind of a storehouse of past ideas. Music encapsulates language often and traditions. It encapsulates conflicts, dreams. It's actually a historical source that can teach us a lot about the past, but music is also really ephemeral. After it's presented, it kind of dissipates, right? So we can only use it as a historical source if we can find a way to see a recording or to learn about how music might have been written down. What interests you about music and its intersection with history, Fulton?
Well, Mike, I'm particularly interested in musicology to an extent. The most obvious thing I can think of is the genre of jazz, and there's this big deal of like seeing who played on what albums, whether that's Ron Carter or Miles Davis. So you get to see all these talented musicians come from all over the world and come together to create something really magical. I think of Miles Davis's Kind of Blue. You have John Coltrane, Miles Davis, Bill Evans, Cannonball Adderley, and all these other famous and talented players.
Yeah, I know you're very interested in the people that are the musicians and their relationships. What else interests you about music?
Yeah, Mike. So I like to investigate the technologies involved with music. You know, you get to see the evolution of recording and instruments. And also with technology itself, with instruments, you can see Bob Dylan going electric in 65. And also the Grateful Dead's wall of sound and alembic basses with Phil Lesh. These new sounds and tones and new ways to play show the constant evolution of genres and creativity. And with that, you ultimately see how artists get to speak through their instruments and their lyrics, which gives me insight to how they see things around the world. But also, learning about this music history allows me to interpret the song for myself and the artist.
Understood. So you're interested in the people, the technologies, and then that emotive quality of music. And what might it mean to work with music as a historical source?
Well, Mike, using music as a historical source, we place music at the center of our conversation and analysis, just like video games. We look at it in its entirety and use it like a written source. When we're working with music, there's two components to consider when placing in our conversation and analyzing it. First, there are written components. We can look at music charts and lyrics, and maybe the ink marks and the erase chords and the different arrangements over time of certain jazz standards or classical songs. Then we can look at LPs and CDs themselves. There might be scuffs on the vinyl where a consumer skipped the needle over, or markings on a CD jewel case where the listener listed their favorite songs off the album. And second, the most important part, I think, to working with music is the non-written components, considering melody, harmony, rhythm, all the things that we hear when listening to music. And then we can consider the recording, production, and interpersonal relationships and kind of music history that I'm interested behind. So like environmental history, there's a lot of interactions going on here. We have to look at band members and their personal relationships, managers, studio workers, and even our reception and reactions as fans at concerts or in media.
So music is a pretty rich source, kind of a social product, and has a lot of information that could be studied. Can you give us a specific example of what we might learn about the past from music if you pick a specific recording or era to study?
Yeah, so if you're interested in the early 1980s America, particularly the West Coast, we can look at Black Flag's seminal 1981 album Damaged, which is a genre-defining hardcore punk album. So this album really enriches our conversation and understanding of the past. We have sounds of the past, voices and instruments that are training future generations to hear voices communicating over time, according to Deanne L. Root. Using Damage from 1981, we can see punk rock as maybe a reaction to jazz fusion, Weather Report, or progressive rock, Asia, and even culturally, so anti-establishment ideology and changes in society that are economic or political. So the first thing that this album does to enrich our discussion is it opens a new window. We can see music and the world and all these cultural interactions from an entirely different angle, one through loud guitars, screaming bass amps, and angry vocals. Second, we can build on Black Flag's Damaged with other sources. For example, we can look at Henry Rollins' book, Get in the Van, a collection of journal entries from his time in the band, and you get to see these interpersonal relationships develop and how audiences maybe received Black Flag if it was a bar in the South compared to a bar in LA.
So ultimately, music is a kind of a time machine. And in this case, the music that you're talking about is also a product of a consumer culture, right? People are buying it, they're participating in that culture, and it's a kind of a commercial product. So in more modern times, music can be a cultural mirror and also a component in the history of capitalism or economic activity like that.
Right on, Mike. And if we look at these cultural mirrors, we can point to two songs on Damaged from 1981. Police Story, which details like police brutality and kind of the militarization of police in the eyes of Black Flag, and the song Rise Above for more of actions, so maybe ways to fight against Ronald Reagan and the patriarchy of the 1980s. And other genres do this too. It's not just hardcore punk. We can look at sea shanties, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But when we go to this consumer culture, there's an implication to music being a time machine. Record labels and musicians are highly aware of making something that a consumer enjoys. They sell super deluxe outtake albums. And this is argued that music is only a time machine and that this happens because we know about the past. We've read Get in the Van or maybe seen, you know, Black Flag on the news or something. And this is all according to a media studies and communications professor, Paul Long at Monash University.
If we can combine music from an era with written sources from that era, we can recreate a pretty rich experience. However, the historical field prioritizes texts as evidence, and our publications are typically text only. This means that music has been neglected in many contexts. It's not a place where historians feel comfortable, and I think it's a place that we can innovate, change, and move our discipline forward.
Exactly. Written and recorded music is the key here. When we capture music and the culture it came from, it becomes a powerful primary source. These sources allow us to place ourselves in the past.
That's right, Fulton. And maybe this can be the basis of our discussion going forward. What can we achieve if we welcome music into our historical conversations? After the break, Fulton and I will discuss how music emerged as an historical source in history and what it allows us to see and hear.
Innovative History uses the technology of Laser, Lou Ayer Student Radio, to record and edit the words you hear today. Laser is Pacific Lutheran University's student-run radio station. They play international jams and have laid-back sports talk. Laser works to represent the diverse music tastes of PLU in the greater local and global communities. Tune in and learn more at plu.edu/laser. LASR. Welcome back to Innovative History. Mike, you have a background in medieval history, the time when music started to get written down. Who did this and why does it matter?
Well, Fulton, what's interesting about this question is that music is a medium that's been around for a long time, but we only have the words that were sung or set to music. We don't have the music itself. And although the Greeks probably had some conventions for recording tones and rhythms, so that they would have some ways of communicating that with characters, that was lost over time. And it was really the Carolingians, a group that flourished in Central Europe from about 800 to around 950 AD, that began to write music down for its own sake. Now, the Carolingians, this would be like Charles the Great or Charlemagne and some of his descendants. And they were sort of established on that border between France and Germany, Belgium in that area. Their goal was to expand their kingdom and then use some of that wealth to reintroduce some of the textural cultures that had flourished maybe during the time of the Romans. So they were very impressed with the Romans and tried to bring back Latin literature. They wanted to bring back history writing, and they wanted to set some of their sacred music to notes. And they wanted to record those and write those down. They also wanted a closer relationship with the Roman Catholic Church, and so they took the opportunity to use music as a way to do that.
So this is a lot of complex history here. Are there any innovative or new books and research that present this information?
Right, yeah, this is a time period that's been fairly well studied, but a new book came out in 2017 by Susan Rankin, who is a professor at Cambridge in the UK, and the name of the book is Writing Sounds in Carolingian Europe. It's a fascinating study that shows that when the Carolingians decided to do that, it took a lot of wealth and a lot of effort for them to create the scribal culture necessary to produce these manuscripts. And it also indicates that there had been a long tradition of oral history where musicians were basically teaching each other without writing stuff down. But when they started to write it down, they had a whole wealth of knowledge that could be captured.
So what does the music look like in these old manuscripts that we can see in Susan Rankin's book?
Yeah, the old manuscripts are vellum, so they're made out of calf or sheepskin. Manuscripts themselves just look like little squiggles that kind of go up when you're supposed to sing up and go down when you're supposed to sing a lower note. Gradually, they do develop the staff with the five lines on it. They began to put notes on there. At first, they all look like whole notes, but gradually they introduce rhythms and then harmonies. And they also create new instruments that they can use, like the medieval pipe organ and music that's used for story traveling, the traveling minstrel tradition, and of course, music for sacred purposes. And so, you know, this is kind of the way music kind of gets embedded in European culture. And as the Renaissance comes, the courts will hire musicians right alongside painters and architects and sculptors, and they will just kind of lavish their cultural prestige all around, you know, from place to place, and different princes are competing with each other, and it becomes part of this high European culture. So music becomes a really important part of European culture after that point. So I think that answers the question about where written music comes from. But it seems that in later history, it's the Industrial Revolution that triggers something inside our cultures to develop recording and communication technologies. So Fulton, can you describe some of the tech that is related to music that appears in the 19th and 20th centuries.
Yeah, so this technology obviously shows our priorities as a society, like the Carolingians, and we've loved these recorded voices and sounds, but the key technological innovation is moving from analog to digital, or physical to computerized. With analog, we can think of the phonographs and gramophones and wax rolls and like the first records, like the 78 RPM shellac record.
Cool, and then why does the medium matter so much, like the LP format? Why does that matter?
Well, the LP format, the long play record, 33 RPM and a third, which you see everywhere now, it was cheap at the time. It had been developed perfectly, and anyone could afford it and see it and use it because the technology was innovating so fast that it was becoming readily available for nearly anyone. But also, the LP set limitations for song lengths and the volume and mixing decisions by producers, dictating how artistic expression is communicated by artists. And there's also more innovations within this that affect the expression of artists as well.
It seems like LPs or vinyl had it figured out, but then something changed after about 1980. What was it?
Yeah, so Donald Fagen's 1982 album, The Night Fly, all digital. You know, and this digital files are computerized. They can be stored on your phone, your computer, such as iTunes, Spotify, which add in and lessen limitations to listening and reproducing and creating music.
Well, my conclusion from this is that recordings allow individual voices to be remembered more clearly, which is something that should interest historians. Historical study, after all, is about restoring lost voices and setting the lives of real people in a social and cultural context. If recorded music can do this, Fulton, we should be using it whenever we can.
Exactly, Mike. And after the break, we will experiment with this approach, using the music of Willie Dunn to learn more about life and politics in North America during the 1960s and 70s, including the struggles and experiences of indigenous peoples.
The Department of History at PLU offers compelling coursework, individualized instruction, and innovative student-faculty research opportunities, including special programs in innovation studies and Holocaust and genocide studies. Prepare for your future by studying the past. See www.plu.edu/history for more information.
I pity the country. I pity the state. And the mind of a man.
Welcome back to Innovative History. You're listening to the music of Willie Dunn and the song I Pity the Country, recorded in 1971. Fulton, who was Willie Dunn and why is he so important in the history of North American music?
Willie Dunn was a half-Indigenous, Mi'kmaq, and half-English artist and political activist from Montreal, Canada. He was known for his innovative and powerful protest songs, such as Half-Breed Blues, I Pity the Country, which we heard, and Charlie. All these songs blended indigenous themes with white country instrumentation and vice versa to create a unique sound in the mid-20th century, late 60s and mid-1970s. His career lasted longer than this, but he was most prolific during this time and put out some of his most powerful work as a multimedia artist.
Who were some of Willie Dunn's best-known contemporaries?
We can think of Canadian folkies, Mike. You might know Gordon Lightfoot, Leonard Cohen.
Fulton, a lot of us know these artists, but not Willie Dunn. His music is similar to theirs, but unique in its own way. I'm wondering how we didn't know about him, and can you catch us up on the recent wave of interest in indigenous folk, rock, and country that's been happening over the last 10 years or so?
Yeah, Mike, so the music of Willie Dunn and this interest in indigenous folk, rock, and country can be traced to another Canadian, Kevin Howes, a music journalist, historian, and producer who put together the compilation Native North America Volume 1 on Seattle's own Light in the Attic Records in the year 2014. This Grammy-nominated historical collection of indigenous folk rock and country traces music from 1966 to 1985, featuring artists like Willie Dunn, of course, Lloyd Chichu, Peter Frank, Willie Mitchell, and many others. Dunn was a powerful contributor to this volume, and he was only one of many neglected artists that need to be heard in this genre.
Yeah, looking at Willie Dunn's career, he seems to pop up in many of the most iconic music venues from the 60s and 70s. For example, he played in the coffeehouse scene in Greenwich Village in New York City, didn't he?
Yes, he did, Mike, and he also fostered his own Greenwich Village scene locally in his home city of Montreal with the Totem Pole Coffeehouse and Restaurant, which he opened with friends. He also popped up in Newport for a few months during 1965, most notably during the Newport Folk Festival, where he butted shoulders with folk icons and legends, talking to them, hanging out with them, playing music, Bob Dylan and Joan Baez. But at Newport, he was mostly influenced by the blues. He met Mississippi John Hurt there, and they really hit it off. Willie opened some shows for Mississippi John Hurt there in that time.
Dunn sounds like he deserved more critical and commercial acclaim than he got. Is that right?
It's 100% right, Mike. And almost everyone who listens to Willie Dunn, critics and casual listeners, will agree with this statement. But, you know, Willie Dunn had the opportunity to earn critical and commercial acclaim during the 1970s. He remained grassroots and committed to direct action instead. He turned down deals at Columbia Records and invites to Nashville to write songs and help record and become somewhat of a session musician. But Willie Dunn just wanted to influence and change the things that he could control, the things that were affecting his life directly. Mike, could you tell us a little bit more about the historical setting of Willie Dunn's music? What was going on culturally in Canada and on the greater North American continent adjacent to Willie Dunn's life?
Fulton, this was a pivotal point in American Indigenous history and the history of music. The Indigenous Red Power Movement went through a period of growth in the 1960s, driven by the American Indian Movement in the U.S. and the Native Alliance for Red Power in Canada. On the other hand, folk, rock, and country, the three genres that Willie Dunn fits into, were influencing each other in new ways in the 50s and 60s. Then they were becoming more popular with North American audiences. Recorded music took off, and landmark events like Woodstock created lots of momentum. These energies were soon combined with social and political struggles, such as the Civil Rights Movement and the Vietnam War. Willie Dunn was Canadian and connected to Indigenous communities there. He soon found himself at the center of the social and political issues of his day. How does his art represent all that was going on socially and musically?
I'll use an example, Mike. Dunn's epic, Ballad of Crowfoot from 1969. This is considered the first Canadian music video and uses the now famous Ken Burns effect, you know, the dramatic zooms on still images. It's an amazing piece of art that shows how well music can enhance storytelling, period photography, and ethical subjects, as we have seen in Ken Burns' The Civil War. When we place the Ballad of Crowfoot at the center of our analysis, it interacts directly with us as historians. Part of this is through chronology, because Willie Dunn uses several dates in the song to describe events in the real life of Chief Crowfoot of the Blackfoot people. The film uses archival photographs to deepen the message about white aggression against Indigenous peoples. There is a verse-chorus-verse structure that depicts the continued impacts of settler colonialism. If you don't know what settler colonialism is, Walter L. Hickson boils it down to this. A history in which settlers drove Indigenous peoples from the land in order to construct their own ethnic and religious national communities. This is through treaties, the introduction of diseases, and various encroachments on Native American life. Let's listen briefly to Willie Dunn's epic, The Ballad of Crowfoot.
53, and you stand the chief of Confederacy. You are the leader, you are the chief, you stand against both. The liar and thief, they trade bridge whiskey, steal your land, and they're coming in swift like a wind-blown sand.
Instrumentally, the song structure and rhythm is reminiscent of Neil Young's 1969 classic, Cinnamon Girl. Dunn blends instrumentation reminiscent of his cowboy country hero Hank Williams and folk pioneer Woody Guthrie with an Indigenous drum rhythm and a coat of Grateful Dead in its non-traditional length. If you couldn't guess, Willie Dunn was aware of the world around him and hip to what's going on. It's the reason why the film was successful and won many awards in its time. But we really get Dunn's artistic and human experience. With The Ballad of Crowfoot, we are witnessing how Willie Dunn feels, sees, and understands the impacts of settler colonialism. He was making a case, a historical case, as to why these experiences and the continued racism and violence against his people are things to be reckoned with, and why this history isn't over. The song works chronologically, and it jumps hundreds and hundreds of years to the present moment, where Willie Dunn writes about how he is feeling like Crowfoot to an extent.
Fulton, can you introduce us to another Willie Dunn song and how it reveals his unique artistry and the context of his times?
Of course, Mike. Half-Breed Blues from 1971 engages in Willie's mixed identity, half Mi'kmaq, half English. Being mixed is a social and historical reality that cultures from all over the world and all throughout time have faced. So Mike, when you place Half-Breed Blues at the center of our analysis and conversation, what do you observe while listening?
Well, the blues progression of this song feels very familiar for sure. But the most interesting part for me is the expression of multiple identities and how the singer feels both at home and out of place in the song's narrative. This is a common theme in North American indigenous cultures. Hearing this song reminds me of the novels of Lewis Owens, another indigenous artist with mixed identities, and his books are fascinated with the rich fusion of native and white cultures in North America and how indigenous communities have been marginalized and recreated over time. There is a growing body of scholarship about how to appreciate and respond to this type of material. In a recent article about Willie Dunn and his contemporaries, Ryan Ben Shavera encourages us to hear the music of Dunn and others, but to listen in new ways, primarily to listen without judgment to indigenous experiences, and then to work to set aside white or colonial settler stances. Mature historical reflection really asks us to do the same thing. When we read a printed or written text, we benefit most when we decenter our own perspective and times. And when we read for historic clues in a piece, discovering as much as we can about the author, the setting, the purpose of the text, and any rhetorical or genre-related strategies the writer may be employing. Listening to Willie Dunn involves similar strategies when we are approaching his work as an historic artifact. When we place his work at the center of our analysis, we surrender to the artist's intentions and articulations, and we simply try to witness their journey. From this starting point, richer communication can take place, allowing us to reevaluate our original point of view. In musical terms, this process also helps us to unbind blues or country music from any particular group. So, Fulton, how do you hear the lyrics and music of Willie Dunn's Half-Breed Blues?
Well, Mike, when I surrender to Willie Dunn and Half-Breed Blues, a different indigenous history is being written. Dunn transports us from the familiar and into the strange. The familiar is by fitting genre conventions. Dunn's vocal timbre textures like that of his contemporaries in the country genre of Johnny Cash or Merle Haggard, and Into the Strange with references to the violent and forced systemic assimilation by the Canadian government with residential schools, the reservation system, and the 1876 Indian Act, which established blood quantum laws. These actions by the Canadian government taught Indigenous peoples how to think about their identities. Stella Metallic, Dunn's Indigenous mother, experienced these events and occurrences but hardly talked about them and her culture, possibly leading Dunn to write these coming lyrics. Well now, I'm just a typical half-breed, got no land, got no deed. All I do is drink my wine and I love my woman till the sunshine. Easy life, no strife, and I ain't got no hang-ups. But we're not getting the full experience until we hear the music, of course. Let's listen to the first verse of Half-Breed Blues again, using the song as a primary text to inform our understanding of this period.
Well now, I'm just a typical half-breed, got no land, got no deed. All I do is drink my wine and I love my woman till the sun shines. Easy life, no strife, and ain't got no hang-ups.
In many traditional blues songs, a singer laments the loss of love or a valued possession. Here, of course, the singer laments the loss of land and of a deed to the land, which, in many cases, was part of the colonial process for indigenous peoples. However, we can probably go deeper than the text when we have a recording to work with. Fulton, are there some hidden gems in the musical composition of Half-Breed Blues?
Yes, Mike, this is an interesting question. As a bonus for this episode, I'd like to pursue this by asking our music director, Felix Halverson, for his opinion about Willie Dunn's music. Although you haven't met him yet, Felix has been composing and playing the background music of all these podcast episodes. Felix, what do you hear in Half-Breed Blues?
This tune is a great example of how composition can impact the meaning of everything as a whole. What I'm hearing in Half-Breed Blues is basically a mix of common bluegrass language and common blues language. And today I wanted to talk a little bit about the history of both of those styles and how Willie Dunn is using them to create something really cool. So here we go. The blues is a vamp style of music that's pretty laid back. You stick on the same chord for a while, you know. You might switch, but you always go back. So if we were to solo over this, it would sound pretty laid back. Right? Okay. Now, a lot of people claim that the blues originated from slavery, and it originated in the southern United States. While this is true that the blues was definitely being played on plantations, people would use it for work songs. That's where we get a lot of the call and response stuff like this. You know, we've all heard that. It's groovy. But I think that it's a bit disrespectful to say that the blues originated from slavery, because that implies that it wasn't a part of African culture before that, and that's simply not true. The blues is a fundamental part of Western African culture, and it actually was a big part before the slave trade was even taking place. Of course, it was a little bit different than what we know it as today, but the true style of the blues all comes from that time period and that part of the world. The music that is playing right now is by a very famous guitarist from Mali named Ali Farka Touré. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And he actually has a really famous quote that, paraphrased, says, "There are no African Americans, there are just Africans in America." And I think that's really, really cool, and kind of goes to show the thing I was talking about earlier, in that the blues is not something that came from slavery. The blues is something that came from Africa. It's African culture. Now, the history of bluegrass is actually very well documented, and it comes from Ireland, Scotland, England. When all those countries in the 1600s started to have people come over to the United States, they began to settle in the Appalachian Mountain region of the United States, and they all started to blend their musical traditions together. There were jigs and folk songs, really fast-moving, anticipated note phrases of songs. Basically, this was music for dancing. People wanted to get down in Appalachia, right? Now, I am by no means a trained bluegrass musician. The people that play this music have really, really insane chops, but this is my best attempt at what an example of this would sound like. All right, so a little bit rough there, but you get the idea. It's a higher energy form of music. It's faster, it's meant for dancing. You could see someone jigging to this. It's really, really great music for high-energy, happy people. Now, here's the coolest thing about half-breed blues to me. Willie Dunn is basically playing the rhythm part, and he is playing kind of fast, but his guitar is featuring the simplicity of the blues. He's vamping on one chord for a while. But there's two guitars on this record. The second guitarist's name is Bob Robb, which is the best name for a bluegrass musician I could ever imagine. And he's basically playing bluegrass phrases in the background. He's giving this song a bit more of an upbeat tempo and a bit more of a happy nature, which is really interesting to me because it kind of juxtaposes the message of the song, which is darker in nature. The other cool thing about this to me is that of the two guitars playing, one of them is playing music that is essentially African-inspired, while the other is playing music that is Western European-inspired. So it is literally a half-breed blues. It's two cultural contexts coming together to make something really meaningful. Thanks so much for having me. If any of the listeners want to check out any more about bluegrass or traditional African blues, I highly recommend checking out the Stanley Brothers, some really good old-school bluegrass there, and then also Ali Farka Touré, who I mentioned earlier. The dude rips. Give him a watch. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Felix, thank you so much for your analysis of half-breed blues from a musical standpoint. It enhances our analysis as historians and shows how powerful of a source music can be when we understand the components within it and behind it. That's musicology and music theory.
So Fulton, as we wrap up our discussion of Willie Dunn and his contributions to the indigenous Red Power movement of the 1960s and 70s, I think we can set out a few things that we have learned. First, musical recordings and texts can be valuable source material for historians and musicologists to use as they reconstruct the past. However, it is important to do our due diligence when using musical materials. We need to learn where the recordings came from, who the artists and producers were, and why they created the recordings that they did. We should be aware of the genre that the music fits into and how various technologies were used to create and record the music.
Right, Mike, and we should roll up our sleeves and do the historical research necessary to place music in its time. The exciting thing is that music can help us recover marginalized voices, such as the thoughts and actions of creative individuals like Willie Dunn. These voices enrich history by communicating not just the ideas of leaders and elected officials, but the true social and cultural history that we see involves gathering the experience of regular people, like you, the listener. Although most people in history don't leave behind writings, Some of them, and like Willie Dunn, have left music and other forms of art for us to appreciate and ponder. Their music is more readily available than ever, with apps like radio, with five O's, Spotify, and of course, the internet.
And I've also learned that music can be a strong ally in the classroom. Fulton, hearing you describe this music with excitement has encouraged me to find places where I can integrate music more fully into my teaching, and I would encourage other teachers out there to use music, not just as window dressing or out music when students leave, but to carefully curate music that is related to specific time periods, from the Middle Ages to the present. When you place music at the center, good things will happen.
Exactly, Mike. Listening to musical performances often involves similar skills to analyzing traditional historical texts. And the more students learn about basic music theory, how instruments work, and how recordings worked, the better they will be at using music and other sources.
So thank you for listening to Innovative History, which explores new and innovative ways that historians are studying the past and the research and technology that will shape historical reflection in the future. I'm Mike Halverson.
And I'm Fulton Barnierson. And we'll see you in the next episode.
Innovative History is produced and recorded in association with a 2021 Benson Family Summer Research Fellowship at Pacific Lutheran University in the Martin J. Neeb Center.
Hosted by Fulton Brown-Anderson and Dr. Mike Halverson, members of the Department of History at PLU, Fulton also served as the editor of the podcast. All music written and recorded by Felix Halverson, except for the Gregorian Chant by Scuola Antiqua in Chicago, I Pay the Country, The Ballad of Crowfoot, and Half-Breed Blues by Willie Dunn. Technology and software provided by PLU Instructional Technologies and Laser, Lute Air Student Radio. Thank you Travis Pagel and John Struzenberg at iTech. Thank you Rosario Yosin, Sean Robinson, and Robert Marshall Wells at Laser.
Special thanks to Kevin Howes, Light in the Attic Records, and Ryan Ben Shubera.
Access to the Martin J. Neeb Center was coordinated through the School of Arts and Communication at PLU. Thanks to Dean Cameron Bennett, Office Assistant Helen Hickman, and former Senior Administrative Assistant Beth Miller. We'll miss you, Beth.
Thanks also to Dale and Julita Benson, founders and sustainers of the Benson Family Foundation.